Welcome to the Unpacked Podcast, a podcast for operators by operators. I'm your co-host, Vignesh, and a partner at Sierra Ventures.
I am Arvind, a partner at Judas & Capital and co-host of this podcast. And on this episode, we are very glad to have Amar Abdallah, who actually had an esteemed career spanning building companies, being part of larger companies, but now he's on to a new journey. So we're going to unpack a bit of the past and the current and his gaze into the future. So with that as context, I welcome Amar to start off, as we do with every session, a bit of your own journey, and then we can sort of unpack a bit more.
I'm happy to be here. I lived the first 5 years of my life actually in Southampton, the UK. My dad was getting his PhD over there. And then after he finished getting his PhD in accounting, auditing, and economics, my dad went back to Egypt. And of course, I was 5 years old, so I went back with him to Egypt. And he was a professor at Cairo University. And ever since I was young, he would tell me, when you grow up, Amar, you're going to be a professor like me. So I graduated top of my class in Cairo University. In Egypt, Cairo University, when you're top of your class, you're automatically enrolled actually to be tenure track, to become a professor. So after that, I came to the U.S. to get my PhD from Stanford. I picked Stanford purely because of the weather. I said, oh, Michigan looks so cold. Egypt is warm. I need something warm. And I ended up picking Stanford. But luckily, that worked out to be a great choice. In my first ride from the airport to the Stanford campus, where I was in student housing, that's when I got to see like all these companies I only heard about in Egypt. Like I saw the headquarters of Oracle. I saw HP. And that was the beginning of me now starting to get this sense that companies are not just this abstract concept that we only hear about from far away. No, this is something that gets built here, and the people here build that. And the Silicon Valley spirit started to materialize itself in front of me. Stanford itself as a school is a very, very entrepreneurial school, extremely entrepreneurial. From day one, they're teaching you about how to do a pitch, how to talk to investors, how to make a business plan, how to think about sales, how to think about marketing, and not just the engineering aspects. They invite speakers from the industry to talk about their companies. And that's very important. And it's part of the reason why I like doing interviews like this. It's very inspirational to see this other person come in and share their humble story of how they came from nothing to be something. When you see them, you see they don't have wings. They don't have like extra ears or extra eyes or halos flying above them. They're just like normal people, just like us. And that gives you the confidence and gives you the inspiration, like, ah, I can do this too. I frequently joke and say Stanford infected me with the entrepreneurship bug. Like, I did not have entrepreneurship in my DNA. I had academic teaching in my DNA. That was my upbringing. Definitely had lots of curiosity, but really didn't have the entrepreneurship bug. And Stanford was the reason why I now switched from being on a professor academic track to being an entrepreneur.
I think since you touched on it, maybe we can just jump into one interesting topic, which is being an immigrant founder and coming to Silicon Valley, getting ingrained in the ecosystem. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about how you build a network. And I think it's helpful for a lot of our founders as to, you know, if you're not from the Bay Area ecosystem, how do you find investors? How do you find co-founders and people?
So first I would say this. I'll say that for immigrants, we are naturally inclined towards taking risk. Immigrants, by definition, we just left everything that we knew, like all of our friends, all of our family, all of our connections, all of our network. And we're coming to start new in a new land when we immigrate. So by definition, we are risk-taking creatures, I would say, especially those of us that make that leap. And hence, entrepreneurship should come naturally to us because entrepreneurship does involve taking significant risk. Now, the other thing that took me some time to learn is back in Egypt, usually the business leaders, they come from families already that have been established. They already had a support system around them that made them become as successful as they are. And then you have to learn here when you come to Silicon Valley, you can do anything. Like you don't have to have connections already. You don't have to have a wealthy family behind you to make you succeed. You don't have to have government relationships to help you get deals going. No, like if you're a good person and you really excel at the thing you're building, the solution you're working on, you can do anything. So that's what my key message is for any new immigrant that just moved here, especially from countries like Egypt, where nepotism and connections play a very big role in success, you absolutely will be able to succeed without any of that. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't need to build relationships. So you're absolutely right. You should seek and continuously be building relationships. Relationships is the most important currency that we have, like in terms of how we can get things done. Now, how do you connect with investors? I was fortunate at Stanford. They did many, many events that helped us connect with investors. So they do help on that front. But I would say if you don't have that, just go to events, because that's how you can connect and build these richer networks over time. And don't be shy. Never be shy to reach out. Yes, you're going to get no 100 times. And then you're going to get yes one time. But that yes that comes one time will never come if you don't get the 100 no's. There's a very famous story of Steve Jobs, right? One of the founders of HP, I can't remember which one, the H or the P. Well, he just emailed them out of the blue, and not emailed them even, there was phone calls back then. He called them on the phone, like a physical phone, and said, I would like some parts because I'm trying to build a small counter. And not only did they give him the parts, they gave him an internship. And that was the beginning of Steve Jobs. So never be shy to reach out for connections.
Thanks for that. Just to summarize, so risk-taking behavior is innate to founders and immigrants. If I were to extrapolate that a bit to your journey of, you know, founding Cloudera and then now Vectara, how do you connect the dots that lead you to think about, okay, this is the right time to build a specific company or a product? And I think I also want to layer on the fact that Cloudera came around in the previous sort of economic crisis of sorts, like, you know, 2010, and now we're in a similar era.
One of the key advice I always give to myself first and to anybody else I talk to that is embarking on starting a company, embarking on the entrepreneurial journey, is, are you more excited by the technology and what the technology can do? Or are you more excited about solving a problem that somebody has? If it's the former, then you should not be starting a company. Just keep working on that technology wherever you are. Keep researching, go join Google, work on it. But if you now found a problem that you're super excited about, and it's like, wow, that problem is a very, very fundamental problem that many people in the world have, that could be on the consumer side or the business side, and I just came across the problem in a very unique way that allowed me to come up with a new solution for that problem, then yes, that's when you give it a try and you start to create your own business and you start to solve that problem. I was leading a large team, about 90 people or so. And while doing that, I came across this very fundamental problem of how data is growing at much higher rates than we were used to in the past, how the types of data coming at us are becoming more varied. So it's not just tables, meaning structured data, it's other forms. And then the type of questions we want to ask are not just the questions you can answer with SQL. SQL is a structured query language. It's one of the most common ways to ask questions out of data. It's useful for many questions, but there is some newer questions that are very hard to express in SQL, or newer tasks that are very hard to express in SQL. So I came across these problems firsthand. And then I was lucky a second time, not just one time, lucky that I was in the right place at the right time in terms of the problem. I was also the right place at the right time in terms of the solution. That within Yahoo, there was another group in the search team at Yahoo working on building this thing called Hadoop. And this thing called Hadoop was being built to exactly solve these problems. How can we scale systems that can work with much bigger amounts of data, be very flexible in terms of dealing with different types of data, and being able to go beyond SQL? So SQL is not the only way that we interact with the data. But I put 1 + 1, like, one, here's the problem. One, here's the amazing solution. And if we put these things together, that would make for an amazing company. And that's when I left Yahoo and teamed up with my co-founders. My co-founders come from Facebook, Google, and Oracle, and they had seen the same problems as well. Like, they, all of them said yes. So that gave us extra confidence, because sometimes you might have identified a very good problem, but only you have that problem in the entire world. Maybe you and 10 other friends, and that's it, right? So that's not going to be a big business. That's going to be a niche business. So to get this extra confirmation that, yes, this problem is actually a repeatable one, we are lucky that we are seeing it before other people, and we're lucky we came across the solution with other people, nothing beats that. Like, if you have that, if you are in a position in a company or in any place and you see that, leave and start a company right away. Like, that is the best signal that you're onto something that can be big.
I'm going to fast forward, and I want to talk about innovation and continuous product innovation and talk about the Cloudera journey, because, you know, Cloudera obviously was a rocket ship for a long time, and Hadoop really seemed like it was the next generation. As, you know, the cloud evolved and the AWS and those guys started to, you know, rise. And I'm curious, as you now reflect on the journey, what were the strategic decisions that you think could have been done differently? How are you thinking about things differently this time, just to make sure that you have that staying power and that ability to really build something that lasts for a long time?
So first, Cloudera is lasting. So Cloudera is still out there. They're making $2 billion a year. The company has 3,000 people. They're growing. They're doing well. Now, Cloudera's growth rate has been impacted by cloud. And by the way, Hadoop was only part of the mix, like Spark was part of the Cloudera distribution as well. And Cloudera is by now, after the merger with Hortonworks, we are the de facto standard. Like 99% of anybody doing something on-premise where they're trying to store large amounts of data and process that data, Cloudera is the answer. And in fact, in many countries where they're skeptical of using Amazon or Google or Microsoft because they're worried about the relationship with the United States, they will tend to use actually Cloudera. With that preamble though, the trend we missed, and I say this without shame, is the how fast the cloud is growing. Like at the same time that we were selling this amazing technology that allows you to build your own clouds, we underestimated how quickly the public cloud itself, Amazon specifically, but others, were growing. And if we had prepared for that trend a few years earlier, then Cloudera would have been in much better shape as a company. The second mistake we did, and that's a very complex one, to be honest, and it's a very hard one, was we IPO'd. So we IPO'd too early. We IPO'd in 2017, and we needed to spend more money at that time on our cloud efforts to build a better cloud solution. The problem is when you IPO, there's a very key metric that investors look at. And that metric was already high for us, so we couldn't make it higher. And that is, what is your R&D spend as a percentage of revenue? So our R&D spend as a percentage of revenue was around 33%. Usually for a software company, Wall Street wants to see that number closer to 20% or less. So we already were at 33%. We needed to go and invest a lot more R&D-wise to really build out our cloud solution, but we couldn't. Our hands were tied because as soon as we would do that, Wall Street would punish us right away. Wow, your R&D spend now is 40%. That's going in the opposite direction of where we would like it to see going. And we had the cash to do it. Like we didn't need more money to do it. We already had the cash in the bank. So if we had postponed our IPO, we could have leveraged that cash in the bank to truly improve our position, which would have given us better lasting power. But it was a very tough call to make because we had early investors that had invested in us about 10 years before 2017. And these investors really wanted to see their return on their investment. So they were very eager for us to go public. We, the founders of the company and the employees, were very eager to go public. So we had this very interesting dilemma between do we go public and achieve this great success of being a public company, or do we postpone it another 5 years and double down on building our cloud effort? In retrospect, of course, hindsight is 2020. I think we should have postponed it. But that played a very big role in tying our hands in terms of truly being innovative and building the cloud motion that we should have built.
There's so many dynamics. There's board dynamics. There's employee dynamics. There's your own personal dynamics. How do you successfully tell yourself to delay gratification, quote unquote gratification, of going public versus making the right long-term decision for the company? Is there any advice that you can give to founders, like a framework or something that they should think about when they make these hard decisions?
The answer is no. And the reason why I say that is because it really depends.
Yeah.
It really depends on so many factors. So the only advice I can give is make sure you get lots of opinions and advice before you make your decision. So when you're faced with this, reach out to a friend that went through this before. Reach out to a friend that never seen anything about this and try to collect a bunch of opinions before you make your final decision. But there's no right answer. Like, for example, maybe Cloudera would have delayed our IPO and then that would have led to us not being able to IPO at all.
Yeah.
Because now with COVID, companies can't IPO right now, right? And even when they IPO, they go out for very low valuation. So, I mean, Cloudera was able to IPO at around $4 billion, and I think we got acquired for $5.3 billion by private equity. So that was a very good exit, like most entrepreneurs dream to have an exit like that. And if we had delayed the IPO, the story might have been very different. So hindsight is 2020, like they say. So in retrospect, I would say what you need to do is have no regrets. Like I have no regrets about the decisions we have made because with all the information we had at our disposal at that time, and by consulting with as many people as we can consult with, we came to the conclusion going for the IPO is the right decision to be making. Now, there are some other entrepreneurs that will tell you, you should always be building for the long term. Yes, you should be always be building for the long term, but you have to keep in mind as well, you have investors that will really want to get the return back. And if these investors don't get the return back and you keep dragging them on with you forever, they're not going to be happy with you. They might never do a deal with you again. They might speak negatively of you. So it's really, really tough. It's very hard. Like there's no easy answer. So that's why I stick with my answer of no. There's no way to just tell you this is what you should exactly do. other than collect as much data and advice as you can get so you can make an educated decision and don't regret. You make the decision, you move on, and that's it.
Someone long ago told me, if you want clarity, go to an optician. Because I think you got to make decisions based on the information that you have at that point in time, which you kind of alluded to. Building Cloudera in the 2008 era and building Vectura now, are there similarities in the undercurrents? Like macroeconomics is similar, capital efficiency is going to be prime again. So anything that you find similar that is going to keep your company building process the same? And how else would you change it? How else would you differently build Vectura now?
So first one, with Cloudera, we started in 2008. With Vectura, we started last year. So in both cases, it's during economic downturns. And I would say that's the best time to be starting a company. That's contrarian because most VCs, they pull back and they invest less, which I think is stupid. Like, I'll tell them, you are stupid. Like, history has shown over and over again. If you were to invest during that downturn, you're now going to catch the upturn when that company matures and you're going to do much better. And for me, that proved absolutely correct with Cloudera, and I'm confident to prove correct again with Vectura. But not just that, like Snowflake was started during that time. Facebook and Google were started during the first Ice Age in 2000s. So there's many, many proofs of that over and over again. The reason why it's good is twofold. First, by the time that company is mature, hopefully now it's the upcycle and they will have a much better IPO. But also, when they're starting their company during the downturn, it's much easier to hire. We'd have no problem with hiring right now at Vectura. Like, it's like if I were starting Vectura 3 years ago, there's no way I could hire as many engineers as I'm hiring right now. We have less competition in terms of speaking with customers because there is less company getting funded that can go and compete with us at the same time. So my number one advice here would be don't be shy or afraid of starting a company during the downturn. In fact, that is when you should be starting the company, assuming you identified a good problem that is looking for a good solution. Now, what are some mistakes I did with Cloudera that I'm not going to repeat again with Vectura? The first one is people, people, people. Once you have identified a good problem and a good solution and you're after it, one of the key reasons why you're going to succeed or fail is if you don't have the right team. And the right team here is not just about the skills. The skills are important, but the right team here is about harmony. This team is an orchestra that is all operating and needs to be singing the same tone at the same time, all helping each other, all working with each other, nobody pointing fingers at somebody else. People are only pointing fingers to help somebody else become better at what they're doing, right? It's always with that lens and just harmony everywhere and momentum and focus. And it's like a team, like a football team or a basketball team that is just nailing it, right? So your team in the first 2-3 years needs to be like that. And one of the mistakes we had at Cloudera, frankly, we did not pay enough attention to that, where there was some problems in the team, some frictions between certain leaders in the team on the engineering side or the sales side or the marketing side, and we would let it go. We wouldn't nip it in the bud right away. Now I'm like, no, like I'm nipping that stuff in the bud right away and do it in a good way. If that leader is not the right leader and you need to part ways with them, you take good care of them, you invest them some stock, you help them get their next job, but don't risk your company for them. It's wrong, right? When you're a small company that's only 10, 20 people, having just one person that is not in harmony or not performing, the impact is not going to be 1 over 20, which is 5% reduction in productivity. It's going to be more because the other people around them will start looking at them and will have some negativity because of them, and their performance will go down as well. So the impact of just one piece that's off is going to be significant in your early years. Not to mention that that becomes the seed, the genesis of everything that's going to come after. So I can't stress enough that lesson I learned at Cloudera, and now I'm applying it 100%. Like, it's one of the key things I focus on, interviewing everybody that joins us, keeping on sync in terms of the relationships and watching it very closely, not letting it slip by whenever I see any friction. So that's number one. Number two, open source. Open source is really, really tough. There is benefits to open source, which, of course, if you want to create a standard, if you want to get a healthy community around you, having something become open source is extremely, extremely useful. It helps with that a lot. But the problem with open source is open source makes your customer become your competitor. I'll say this again. Your customer becomes your competitor. We had many customers that said, we're not going to pay you any money. We are using your Cloudera product. We're using CDH. CDH was our platform, Cloudera distribution for Hadoop. We're using it. They're using our product as is. And tell us, we're not going to pay you money. We don't think we need you. we'll go hire 10 engineers that will do this and use your product to do whatever we want. So it becomes very hard to monetize when you put yourself in that situation. And then the same thing happens when, without mentioning their names, but there is one or two vampire cloud vendors out there. There's really just one. There's one vampire cloud vendor out there, and their name starts with A, ends with N. And the vendor, they just take any software you have and just deploy it right away, and then they compete with you head on. And there's no way for you to really challenge them, because you will go in and say, okay, hey, company X, buy my platform. It's open source. And the reason why you're going to buy it from me, because I'm going to give you enterprise features like security, stability, reliability, uptime, whatever. Guess what? Amazon is, sorry, I said their name now, but Amazon is amazing at that stuff. They're really, really good at doing that stuff, right? So it becomes very hard to compete with them. And that's why you see all of these vendors now with open source flipping their licenses. They will flip the license to a license that is less permissive to prevent Amazon from grabbing it or prevent the customer from not paying them, or they will fork, right? So they will have two versions. They will have the open source version, but then they will have the cloud version, like Databricks, for example. Databricks has the cloud version, and the cloud version has many features that they don't put in the open source version, right? So you get the open source version, you try it out, but then eventually there is a need, oh, I need to work with them now because I want these other very cool features that don't exist in the open source. So you need to have one of these techniques. So with Victara, we are choosing not to be open source at our core. Our core models, our core IP around machine learning and large language models, we're keeping that proprietary. But we're doing things from open source around the perimeter that makes it easier for you to use the core, but not the core itself. And that way we solve both of these problems, where the customer now still sees our value and what we're useful for, and we prevent these vampire clouds from just taking your software and running with it. So that's the second lesson that I learned. And then the third lesson that I learned is complexity. Complexity slows down sales significantly, right? Many engineers love complexity because it gives them more choices. There is more components, there is more features, there is more capabilities. They can do more things. Cloudera was a very powerful platform, very, very powerful, very, very complex because of that power, which slowed down our growth. Because what we discovered is there was few engineers in the world that truly had the knack to leverage and take advantage of that complexity. Instead, what we should have focused on, and that is what Snowflake focused on, and by the way, that's also what MongoDB focused on, and I'm very jealous of both of them for how much more successful than Cloudera they became, was simplicity and ease of use. How can we build the most simple developer experiences to be up and running productive in no time, with security, with scalability, with availability, with access control, with. And they really, really focused on that, right? To the extent of giving away fee, like they would not add this new feature if it's gonna lead to more complexity. So that's the third lesson I learned, and this is the lesson I'm applying at Victara as well. We're making sure in everything we do that we start with simplicity first, and there has to be very good reason why we're going to add more functionality that might introduce complexity. Yeah.
I think those lessons are all very interesting, and there's a ton of stuff that we're going to dig into, I guess, coming up here on the hiring front and the go-to-market front and the product front. Maybe let's start with number three first. I'm curious a little bit about the idea of simplicity, because simplicity can also imply lack of technical moat and lack of technical depth. And it feels like there's an art to being able to blend deep, technical, like really good product with being simple. And I'm curious, just how do you think about that?
I actually don't see them as contradictory. Like Snowflake is such a simple API where you can upload your data and you can start running SQL queries against that data. And they're going to take care of everything else for you. You don't need a DBA anymore. They're going to take care of the load balancing. They're going to take care of the data skew detection. They're going to take care of the query plan optimization. They just do all of that for you. And that's very engineering hard stuff to do, by the way. But then the end result, if they do that correctly on their side, then the API and the experience the developer will be seeing would be way simpler. There is many other examples of that in the consumer world, for example. Like iPhone, Apple and iPhone, they try to focus a lot on simplicity. That simplicity is one of the core elements of the designs versus Android, which by the way, I prefer Android because there are different users in the world as well. Like I prefer Android because Android gives you more choice and more flexibility and more control and more complexity, right? Both are important. Like there is audiences that like both. Like Cloudera is still doing fine. There's many engineers that love the Lego blocks and love the complexity and love building everything themselves. But there's a lot more developers out there that want the simplicity. So I'm not saying one is the right answer. I'm saying you need to know which one you're going to be anchoring on as the thing that's going to define your company. Yeah. And you're right. It is hard.
You mentioned three times, people. I think it's core tenet to any company building. Yes. So let's focus on that. How do you sort of align culture and hiring? I guess, you know, they're synonymous, but could you give us some color around what you look out for in terms of hiring across different functions and different stages? I mean, you have the benefit of looking at different stages as well.
Hiring and recruiting is a flawed process, meaning that there will be an error rate. We cannot have an error rate of 0%, right? So meaning you will end up hiring people that will not be the right fit for one of many reasons. Could be just a cultural fit, but also could be experience. They were very good at selling you that they can do it, and they joined you and they are not able to do it. I have no doubt that you will hire somebody in your first 10 people that is not the right hire. And the best thing you can do during the hiring stages is if you can hire known quantities. So known quantities meaning is somebody you worked with before or one of the people you hired worked with before. That helps a lot in minimizing the probability of a piece that doesn't fit the orchestra that you're trying to create. But it's also very hard to do that for every hire you need. But you should be optimizing for that as much as you can. Now, culture is a part of the puzzle. So culture is about how we work and operate together as a team, which is a layer on top of the skills. So the skills are important, but then culture is also very, very important. So every company can have its own culture that will work for them. For example, as you might know, Apple has a culture of being very secretive. The teams are all working separate from each other. They don't really know what they're working on, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fine. Oracle has a very top-down culture where the commands come from above and you have to listen and execute them. That works for them. That's fine. You have to know what is the culture that works for you and what you're building towards and make sure you're hiring people that fit that culture. And that's why we make it part of the interview process to tell the new hires, this is our culture. So I tell new hires straight out, if you are an arrogant, disruptive cowboy, this is not the right company for you. Don't come here. Go work for some other company. And that seed of first 10, 20 people you're going to hire, they become the foundation now that as you scale to the bigger stages, you keep elevating and reinforcing that culture. I will also admit to you, I was not successful in scaling the Cloudera culture beyond about 300 people. After 300 people, it broke down. We did not have a uniform culture. We started having sub-team cultures evolve. And some of these sub-team cultures were not aligned with the main culture of the company. So actually, I don't have an answer to that question of how can you keep culture going beyond a few hundred people. If you ask any HR person or any training person, how do you keep the culture going? It's all about first making sure everybody's aware of what are the culture. That's number one. Number two, whenever somebody does something that is culture additive, meaning it's speaking to the culture, you recognize that publicly in front of everybody. So everybody knows this engineer is getting this recognition right now in the all hands because they were amazing with our customers. They put the customer first above everything else, which is one of our cultural attributes, for example. Then now everybody sees and knows that that's one of the cultural elements we care about, and that reinforces it. And then separately, when somebody does something that's against culture, you do it in private with them directly. You don't, of course, embarrass them in front of everybody. But eventually, when one of these people separates with the company, they also look at that. We don't say it, of course, but they can tell, oh, that person is now separating because they were a disruptive cowboy. Right? And so they see we care about that. But still, it kind of breaks down around 300. Like, I couldn't really crack that nut. So if you have good answers for it, or if any of your audience listening to us right now have a good answer for how do you scale the culture in a healthy way beyond hundreds, I would love to hear that.
Definitely. I think part of it, though, does rely, like you said, on having a really strong foundation of people from the early days. One of the things that you really prioritize is a learning mindset, and it's something that you think is really, really important for people to have. In addition to that learning mindset, what are the things that make you want to hire somebody versus, you know, somebody not being a fit? And are there any, like, interview questions? Like, how do you actually go about figuring out if that person is the right fit for the culture you're trying to build?
So I do have a couple of interview questions I ask. I'm not going to share them here on the show because I want people to be prepared for them when they come in. But they're open-ended questions. And the question actually serves two purposes. Part of it is checking for some of the attributes that I like to have in people and on our team. Attributes in terms of work, not necessarily culture per se, but then there is also culture at the same time. So I try to test for both of these things. To answer your question on what are some of the things I like seeing, teamwork is very, very important to me. I'm a very big believer that a great team will always beat a team of greats. So if you get a bunch of greats and make them work together, meaning they're all A-plus players, but they are not really good at working with each other. And you get a bunch of maybe B-plus players or B players, but they're amazing at working with each other. They will beat the A-plus players, in my opinion. Like, I'm a very big believer in that. So I always look for that. Like, is that person I'm talking to right now confident? They are confident. They are smart. They are proud of their skills, but not to the point of arrogance. Not to the point of, and I am the best one on the team. It's like, no, I'm going to help the whole team be as good as me. So we as a team are all great, right? So that's one of the things I look for. The other key characteristics I look for is curiosity. So at early stage, which is the stage we are at right now with Victara, curiosity is very, very important. So I'm not just executing and focused and that's the only thing I can see. No, I'm inspecting, introspecting the data as it coming in, introspecting the feedback of the customers and users as it coming in so we can adjust the path because we don't know if we are on the right path or not yet. Now, that is different in later stages. Later stages, when you already have figured out the path, you already have repeatable revenue, you're now really growing the revenue, then you shift the type of people now to be more red, more about execution. So there is no one answer fits all. It depends on what stage you're at as a company. But to answer your question briefly and quickly, right now, I look for these two things more than anything else. Teamwork. And curiosity. Yeah.
I want you to sort of share with the audience a bit about Victara.
I would say first, have you heard about the hallucination problem within the context of large language models, not within the context of California and what you can buy from stores in California now? So as you know, hallucinations in large language models is that they will make up stuff. And the reason why they make up stuff is because they're really doing very, very significant compression of information. You're compressing down petabytes and petabytes of data into a few gigabytes. And by definition, from information theory, that means it's lossy compression. It's not going to be storing the original data in its original high fidelity form. It's a distilled down subset of data that allows it to a large extent to reconstruct the data, right? Similar to how, for example, JPEG or MPEG compression works. It's lossy, right? So you're not getting the signal original as is. You're getting a signal that's good enough to pass as the original signal. So that's how large language models work. Now, if any company wants to use GenAI within their organization, and if it's a business as opposed to a creative, if you're writing a novel or writing a sci-fi movie, hallucination actually is a good thing. That's a feature, not a bug, right? Because now I want to be creative. I want to make up stuff to be part of this new movie or new script or new novel I'm writing. But in a business context or a legal context or a financial context, a medical context, an accounting context, and even an engineering context of building a bridge or writing code, I don't want you to be super creative. I want you to be more accurate and factual than not. So that's one of the key problems that we solve. So first, at a very high level, our product is a trusted Gen AI platform. What does that mean? That means we can generate answers, generate emails, generate legal drafts that are a function of your own data that you have in your organization that you have been generating over time, and do it in a way that minimizes hallucinations. We actually have not solved it completely. We still have a 3% chance of hallucination materializing itself in the results. That's the best in the industry, by the way. 3% is the best in the industry. But we solve some other very key problems. For example, access control. So you're a partner, so you have access to more data than an associate who just joined the firm, right? So if the associate asks the model a question, the response that they get back from the GenAI system should not be the same one that you would get as a partner. You have more visibility. You have more access control rights. So how you control the output of the model to be adaptive to the person, right? And there's no way to do it with normal techniques. But we have a technique that works very well for doing access control on the generative output. Explainability is very important. So if I am going to be generating an answer, generating an email, generating an investment memo for why I should invest in this company versus not, you want to explain, like, why are you saying this? Like, where did this come from? What's the lineage of this decision and why you put it there as a generative output? So we're able to provide you with explainability of the outputs. We're able to provide you, as I said, access control, minimize hallucination, minimize copyright infringement. Some of these models can produce copyrighted materials. So you want to minimize that, minimize bias. The opinion of the model on opinionated stuff might be biased. So you want to mitigate that as much as you can. So this is really what we do. We allow you to use GenAI in your organization as a function of your own data. And I do it in a way that mitigates all of these issues that are critical to overcome to be able to use this in a business context. Now, what are the use cases for this? people ask me this question, and I give them two answers. The first answer I give is, we really have a new wave of how humans can interact with machines coming upon us right now. This Gen AI is what's enabling that wave. That is very similar to when the iPhone came out and touchscreens came out. That was also a new wave. When a new wave happens, there is some use cases we can see. Oh, we're going to take this app that was working with the mouse and keyboard and now make it work with our fingers. We're going to take this app that's working with the mouse, keyboard, and fingers and make it work with our voice, right? So that's kind of like the obvious stuff. But there will be new apps that will be get created or new use cases that will get created that we couldn't even think of. Like Snapchat, we couldn't really predict Snapchat when the iPhone was coming out. Yet Snapchat now is something that many, many people use. So with that said, there will be use cases that I cannot predict for you right now. But what I know this technology is working for really, really well right now is these two use cases. The first one is knowledge discovery. So this is you now as an investor injecting all of your investment memos, all of the PowerPoint decks you get from entrepreneurs, all of the analyst reports from JP Morgan, Bloomberg, Goldman Sachs, and others. You ask the system, oh, I have this new entrepreneur pitching me on blockchain from Spain. What are some reasons why I should invest versus not invest? And then the model will give you a response grounded and governed by your previous decisions, not just you, but other people in your firm, but also taking into account all of this other data that you have fed into the system. So we call that knowledge discovery. Very, very important for lawyers, for investors, for medical researchers, for media and news analysts. There's so many, many people that need that kind of capability. The other use case is customer support. So customer support is a very natural use case for this because it's all about, give me the answer for how I can use this application. And we call that an answer engine versus a search engine. With a search engine, you get back a list of documents. Here are the list of documents and you have to click on them and read them. Versus with our approach, you're getting back the answer. So for example, if this is a system like Workday, Workday is a HR system and you want to file your vacation. It's very hard to file a vacation in Workday. You have to go read the documentation, which fields should I fill, which forms, what should I put in them. Versus now imagine you ask the system, I want to file a vacation, what should I do? And I tell you, step number one, do this. Step number two, do that. Step number three, you're done. And guess what? If we now nail these steps over and over again, then it will move from the answer engine stage, which is where we are today. And when we get hallucination to be 0% versus where it is right now, then we move on to what I refer to as the action engine stage. And action engine, that is nirvana. Action engine is the final step in the evolution of how we humans can interact with software. We just interact with software in the same way I'm interacting with both of you right now. Just talk to each other and get things done.
Not to digress too much here, but I really do think stuff like Victara is really interesting, but it does feel like some of the application layer stuff has been very underserved. And I think there'll be some really, really interesting companies that pop up. But I want to go back to product market fit. And we talked a little bit about this early on and how do you discover the idea? And I think you've really latched onto a good idea, which is access and identity management in the Gen AI world. But there's a difference between having a good idea that people say, hey, I like it, versus scaling your go-to-market, you know, at 100 miles an hour. Is there any practical advice that you can give to founders about like knowing when to speed up or when you're heading 100 miles an hour off a cliff?
First, I'll always say it's harder to do this right. As we have seen right now, many companies doing layoffs with very big amounts because there is macro effects that can affect you when you're going through something like that. But at the very, very early stage, which is the stage I'm at right now, the key point is absolutely founder selling. You as a founder need to be selling the software, at least for enterprise software. Now, I'm not talking about consumer stuff, which is not my expertise, but for enterprise software, you need to be the one selling directly for the first 12, 15 deals in the company. So by me being involved in that process in these early days, I get to make sure that yes, the problem is there. They want to do Gen AI and they really care about access control. They really care about explainability. They really care about hallucination. The fit is there. And then as I see that pattern over and over again now happen across customers in different industries, then now you know. Now I have a solution that's repeatable. It has the traction. It's solving a real problem. Now I should press my foot on the gas. But before that, pressing your foot on the gas can be very, very dangerous. You can end up really hurting yourself.
What would you advise for later stage? Like, I mean, are there sort of rinse and repeat techniques that sort of worked for you? And then distribution, where do you think it lands in this era?
By definition, if you go into a healthy market, there will be large incumbents. If there is no large incumbents, that means you might want to question yourself, am I solving a good problem or not? So if you look at blockchain, there was no large encumbrance in blockchain. Even when Microsoft and Google started dabbling, they dabbled very little because they didn't really see the problem. They didn't see the demand. There was some demand, but not a lot. I mean, chain at large. Of course, Bitcoin itself, I'm a big believer in. But if you look at GenAI, the large encumbrance are jumping quicker than I've ever seen in history. Like, I've never seen any large incumbent jump onto a new technological trend as quickly as is happening this year. Across the board, really. So that can freak you out as an entrepreneur and say, oh, now this game over, I should give up, I should leave. Or that can empower you. Okay, this is now proof that this market is a serious market. And I have now the singular focus of solving this problem in a very, very easy to use way for that industry. So I can differentiate from these bigger incumbents that focus on many, many, many things. And I have no shame in saying this, and I said it many times on this podcast. I look at Snowflake as one of the best examples of that. Like, Snowflake was amazing because they came in not just into a new market, which is the big data one that Cloudera was in, but also an existing market, which is all the big databases. Amazon had Redshift. Microsoft has CosmoDB and SQL Server. Google had BigQuery. And despite these large incumbents that were doing amazing already and had massive market share, Snowflake came in and sliced the heck out of all of them. So how did they do that? They did that by recognizing these two things. First, this is a problem that needs to be solved. It's real. I'm not going to be daunted by the large incumbents. I'm going to look at what they are not doing correctly and strategically differentiate and do that way better than them. And in their case, that was ease of use. So that's my response to that second part of your question, is don't let the large incumbents freak you out. You have to learn from them and see what you can use against them to be able to succeed as a company. To your first question, in terms of scaling is really hard. Scaling is very, very hard, and it needs different types of skills in the company. And that's why many companies during their scaling stages, and Snowflake as well, I'm going to keep going back to them, they almost replaced the entire management team completely because they realized that the team we had before was the great team for the step that we reached right now. But for this next step now of scaling, we need different kind of skills. And that's what makes it hard. Now, I'm really hoping at Victara, my team will be the same team that will continue to do that. But we should not let that blind you. Like, sometimes if you see, no, the speed I need to be moving at right now needs somebody that is not trying this for the first time. They're not experiencing these mistakes for the first time. They have done these mistakes before, and they know what the answer is to be able to move at the speed that we need to be moving at. So I know that's kind of like a cop-out answer to your question, but that's what you need to be cognizant on, is you need to make sure you have the right skills on board for the scaling stage that you're at.
We have three sections of this podcast: decouple, decrypt, and decompress. We come to the last section, how do founders take a step back and recharge?
I would say between companies, you have to take a break. So after Cloudera, I purposely took a break, both in terms of time off. I took about 6 months off, but I also worked for Google Cloud for 2 years, which I consider that to be a break as well, by the way. Because when you are the founder, the stress is all on you. Like, it's all on your shoulders. You're stressed out. Oh, I might lose the investor's money. I might not be able to pay the payroll next month. Like, it's all on you. It's all on you. The stress level is insane. It's insane. I want to scare you from doing your own company. You should only do your own company if you're ready for that level of stress. It's not about working hard. Working hard is easy. I can work hard anywhere. It's about, can you handle the stress? So make sure you take a break, relax, recharge, make sure you're ready for that next 10-year, 15-year journey of building a company. But while you're building that company, absolutely making sure that you have a mechanism to de-stress is very important. And there is a couple of things you need to have there. First, you need to have good coaches or good advisors that you can reach out to just complain and cry and, like, unload, really. Because it's going to be very hard to unload on people with you in the company. In front of people in the company, you should be 100% positive and 100% energetic and inspiring. So you cannot show them any weakness because you want them all to be operating at full speed. So you need to have these good advisors on the side where you can do that, right? Where you can express your concerns, where you can express your emotions, et cetera, et cetera. And number two, you need to have a good hobby that allows you to de-stress. You need to have a good hobby that allows you to switch off your brain completely from work for like 15, 30 minutes so that you can reset. For me, that hobby is video gaming. I'm a video gamer. I love doing video gaming, and it does that for me. When I'm doing that, my brain cannot process anything else because you have to be monitoring and observing everything going on. So it switches off your brain from thinking about work. And this is really what you want. You want to switch off your brain for 20, 30 minutes to think about something else so that you're not overloading. That stress is not continuing to accumulate and overload. You need to have that as part of your routine and give it the importance it deserves. Don't think of it as, oh, work-life balance, now I'm giving life too much. No, if you don't give life too much, the work will suffer. the work will suffer. And the other very key advice for handling stress that everybody will tell you, and I heard this from Arianna Huffington. Arianna Huffington is a big believer in this. Sleep, sleep, sleep. Don't sacrifice your sleep. Different people need different hours of sleep every day. For me, the right number is 6 hours. I have to get my 6 hours. And I'll make sure I get my 6 hours, because I know if I don't do that, I will stress way more than normal, and I will make mistakes that I will regret. So I cannot stress enough the importance of sleep. And many younger entrepreneurs, myself guilty of this, I would give up on the sleep. I would give up on the sleep so I can get everything I need to get done. Never again, like never again. Focus on your sleep. I cannot stress the importance of that. Yes.
I think this is the first time on the podcast we've heard first-person shooters for decompressing software.
I'm not recommending first-person shooters. I'm recommending you need to have a hobby. That's the key point. You need to have a hobby that you're passionate about.
No, fair enough. Yeah. I want to end with one last thing before we close here, Amr, which is you've been really passionate, and I think you've talked a lot about building up the startup scene in the Middle East and Egypt in particular. I'd love to just hear your thoughts on, like, what are the trends driving it? How are you seeing the talent evolve there? Just as a little bit of background, at Sierra, we invest mostly actually outside the Bay Area. About 70% of our deals are actually outside the Bay Area. And we really believe that there are a lot of really strong founders that just don't have access to the capital, but given the right capital and the right guidance, they can, you know, be great builders. And I'm curious, kind of, what are you seeing coming out of the Middle East and Egypt?
I really want to see many countries in the Middle East participate more in this entrepreneurship startup ecosystem across the world. Because the potential is there, the people are there, the intellect, knowledge is there, the problems are there in droves. We have many problems that are waiting to be solved in very smart, unique ways. So that's really the motivator, is to help people break that barrier, the barrier I had, by the way. We're kind of bringing this show full cycle here to what I said at the beginning. Like, the barrier I had when coming from Egypt was, oh, only the people that have strong government connections and wealthy parents and they can create big companies. We just work for the big companies. We never go and create. And I'm trying to lead by example, showing people I'm one of the people who were not like that, who came here to the US. I only had like a couple of thousand dollars in my pocket. That was it. I had a wife and I had a kid and I had more kids coming on the way, and still was able to make a significant impact. Because if you have that willpower and intent, and you really pursue it, and then you meet amazing investors like yourself that stand by your side and advise you and help you do it, you can do it. There's a very good chance that you can do it. That's my intention, is opening up the eyes of the people that you can.
That's great. Very motivational way to end the podcast. We really, really appreciate you jumping on with us. This hour has definitely flown by for myself, and I'm sure for Arvind also. I think there are a lot of really good pieces of advice and nuggets in here for our listeners. So thank you again so much for taking the time.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.